Thanks for listening to Outcast World. You lock your front door, don't you? You wouldn't go out and leave the front door open. Well, that's essentially what you're doing when you're not using a VPN. Right now, your data is being tracked, stored, and sold by loads of people. For a lot of people that are listening to this show, that is not just annoying, it can also be very risky. NordVPN fixes it. It's fast, it's reliable, it's number one for consumers, and it takes less time to set up than ordering a takeaway. Outcast World listeners can get NordVPN for under £3 a month. That is up to 75% off. Just go to outcastworld.net. The link's at the top. Turn it on. Forget about it. Make yourself safer online with the number one NordVPN for under £3 a month at outcastworld.net. Hello, hello, it's Graeme Smith on Outcast World, nominated Best Interviews Podcast at the British Podcast Awards 2025. On today's episode, what's it like growing up queer in religious and deeply conservative Iran with the threat of the death penalty for queer people? I spoke to the author of a new book called The Ayatollah's Gaze. His name is Majid Parsa, about just that.
You're right. A lot of people don't know kind of what's happening behind the scenes, and you might hear snippets of stories here and there about like gay life in Iran. So I started with the dream kind of to show both sides of that world in a young teenager is just a little bit confused and doesn't know where he actually fits in. So I start with that, kind of contrasting the dream of dreaming about a man and really being excited by that, but at the same time having to wake up in the morning to eat before another day in Ramadan with a very religious family. So yeah, that's how I kind of started picturing it. This book has got that angle of danger all around it. Iran is one of the very few countries which homosexuality is still punishable by death. And as much as I assume that everyone knows, many don't. They know that it's not a nice country to be gay, and but that's as far as knowledge goes. But actually, no, there is a law and it's punishable by death. And I thought I should get that in straight first of the beginning and say, okay, the book that I'm going to say is under this shadow. That's kind of really hanging over us.
You know, there's that picture that newspapers use quite a lot of them, two young queer men being condemned to hang. And it was one of the most moving images I've ever seen. It's before the those two young men, it was probably 20 years ago, were executed. Did you feel like going through, moving through society where you did, that could be a fate that could happen to you? Or was that a kind of a real outlier?
No, it's only afterwards, when I think about it later on, that it kind of becomes a thing. At the time, no. I think when you're living something, you don't realize that this is always there. It's that ominous presence of a law that could punish the homosexuality by death. As much as I know there is that law, but it wasn't kind of something that it reminded me every day or was affected by in any way. So I just carried on like many, as we would, and did all the things that were meant to be haram and punishable by death and everything, regardless of what's written in the law. And I think that's one big point I want to make in the whole book, that life goes on. Yeah, it's not as bad as kind of the title shows or whatever people think about it. It's actually, there's lots of fun, there's lots of love, lots of joy.
So let's talk about the title, The Ayatollah's Gaze. What's the meaning behind that? Is that a play on words as well?
It is, it's a yeah. little bit, yes. So I thought when I tell people I'm writing a book and it's called The Ayatollah's Gaze, the first thing they would just have lots of eyebrows, but then I have to spell it out, so well, it's with a Z, so it's not, and this, oh, okay, that's a good play on the word. And obviously I thought if I don't want to put like G-A-Y-S, because that would be quite a target on my back. Yes. Attached to actual gaze. So I just like, okay, this is just treading that fine line that I could put gaze in.
But
there.
Where is the fine line? Do you ever feel that? That's another thing, I guess, is in the background, is the Salman Rushdie kind of story, isn't it?
It is. So that's, I think, I mean, the one is the fact that I didn't write the book from a place of prejudice. I suppose when I wrote my very first few drafts, those were the kind of the angry versions of that. I'm angry at this and that, so that no one should get hold of those, basically. Mm-hmm. But as I started going along,
you moderated them, did you?
I moderated them. I softened the edges and said, like, listen, actually, it's not my job to say how I feel about all of this or pass a judgment. I'm just going to tell my story and leave the judgment to readers. So if you read the book, it's not actually that controversial. There's not much there against the religion or about the politics. It's just them telling the story and to take the reader. So I feel a little bit less worried about that angle kind of when it comes to like Salman Rushdie and whatever. And the other bit is obviously I've written this book under pseudonym, so I've changed details, I've changed my name and all of those things, so I've tried to kind of protect myself as much as possible.
So I mean, that's what I was thinking, really. There is that, and we talk about the Salman Rushdie thing, that was obviously much more of a direct challenge to the regime. It couldn't have been more of a challenge, could it, to sort of the establishment in Iran. But what you're doing, I guess, is also a challenge to how the country of Iran wants to be perceived around the world, and with that, with the way the world has changed, that does kind of put a target on your back. And I guess that's even though you're not going as far as Salman Rushdie, like in your country at the moment, you know, women are being sometimes taken off the street just for kind of basic kind of not wearing the correct dress. So you writing a body of work like this probably for some people is a real challenge.
One thing that I think this story pushes, at least the way I've tried to put it out, is there's lots of kind of all of those sort of stories that you hear and all of those which is real, it happens. But mine kind of was the stories in between, the bits that you don't hear about, because the bit that makes the headline is always the negative, awful bit. But in between all of those awful headlines, there's lots of life that's happening, and it's kind of normal, at least for us, and it's parties and lots of fun, and I want that. I think the half of my book is about the kind of Tehran's gay scene, which is flamboyant and colorful and full of divas and all of that. So, and that still goes on and thrives, if anything.
Tell me about that, because I guess there's nothing that would make people more excited to be on that scene than the fact that it was restricted access to it. I guess that when you're on that scene, it feels even more special because you know that it's kind of denied from you. I get bored of going out and being on the scene and doing the things because it's so available. I'm kind of like, oh, yeah. But if I'd not had that chance to maybe explore that for myself, I think I'd be very drawn into that. Tell us about that scene in Tehran, because that for me is fascinating, you know.
Yeah, that is so true. And I totally get you, because here, when I'm in London, I rarely go out to any gay scenes or any gig. I don't do any of that. But in Tehran,
once a year thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. And in Tehran, I was so active with all of it. It's so true that it's thrilling. It's quite thrilling to kind of be part of that community. And you know, it's just this vine branches that kind of the gossip just carries who's having this house party and who's having the other one, and just hear from this and that. And as much as at the time it didn't feel like it, I felt at the time this is an enormous community. It wasn't, it's a small community. Yeah. But once you're in it, you just know people, and it just that sense of community kind of underground, it's actually quite nice. It's quite thrilling.
It's empowering. It sounds it. What kind of things so people are, obviously you can't go to official venues, it's all private house parties, is it? How does that pan out? Do people just message each other on WhatsApp? What goes on?
Well, lots of house parties There were some websites. I mean, there were dating websites which weren't filtered, at least at the time when I was using it. One was called manjam.com. It was a famous one that everyone was on it. But I mean, that's where you date. But in terms of parties, once one decided to have a gay party, it's a lot of word of mouth. And there were these little pockets. People had these groups and little group of five who would just always stick together. It's almost little gang style.
They would just hang out with each other generally then?
Hang out with each other, and then one of them holds a party, and then one of them who's got connection to another kind of little gang, they would let them know, and they will call their mates, and they had their own rivalries and all their sort of gossip and everything amongst them anyway. But it was fascinating. I mean,
it sounds like living in Manchester and being on the gay scene. It does. Like, you've just got small groups of people just chilling at each other's places. I guess you've got that the whole world over, kind of like a lot of nightlife has kind of moved private, hasn't it, thanks to the apps. What kind of parties are we saying? So I'm just for clarification, But the kind of parties is the same spread of parties you'd have in London, where, you know, you have people hanging out with each other, but then if people were going around to someone's for a party, that would be maybe like a sex party. Is that not the kind of thing that would happen?
No, it wouldn't be a sex party. It would be mostly just music. I mean, people go really over and beyond. I held a couple of parties. I've written about them in the book, and yeah, that was quite stressful. But what I went through, I kind of, at least a lot of people did the same. You hire a sound system and laser and black light and all of that. In the house, and nice. And just put all the furniture in one room and just turn the living room kind of into a dance floor. Yeah. And listen to lots of Iranian pop and lots of Rihanna and Madonna. And
so is that what people are listening to? They're listening to Iranian pop, they're listening to Madonna, they're listening to, like, is that the kind of the music that's being played?
Yeah. So usually they play a lot of Western music, which is kind of Rihanna, Madonna at the time, at least. And then they would put a few traditional kind of, not traditional, like Iranian pop, famous like for dance, just in the middle. Mm-hmm. They don't put too much of it, because then people will turn up their nose and say, oh, this party is not too Western enough.
You said it was a bit stressful holding them. What was stressful? Just like stressful because you're throwing a party, or stressful because you're kind of throwing a bit of a party and you know that if someone gets wind of it, the wrong person, then you're in trouble?
Yeah, mostly that, because as much as I said from the beginning, like, kind of there is this shadow of morality police. We have this branch of police nowhere else seems, even though we've got our morality police, that they can... they can and they do kind of come to parties, bang on doors. The majority of times you can pay them off, but sometimes they're really...
Right.
Well, a lot of people still prefer the money, but then there are the devoted ones who will come in and take people and arrest them. And if there's alcohol in a party, that's even worse. You get lashes for it. The thing with gay parties is that in Iran, mixing men and women is kind of illegal, and that's a big no-no. Right. But if like kind of morality police stumbled upon a gay party where just a bunch of dudes hanging around one another,
you should get away
with
that then, probably.
They could. Maybe. I mean, it's a twisted way of kind of getting away with being gay. So it was easier.
Right, yeah, it would be. And I guess that, you know, a lot of people are going to... The way we have to kind of fit, don't we? We have to pass in society a lot of the time. There's nothing going to make you want to pass any more than the threat of that legal issue, isn't there? So I guess that some people might be able to just slip under the radar. Could you give, for people who aren't aware, just a brief outline of what goes on in the book, what the premise of it is?
Well, the book is my life. I've changed the bits and bobs of details again for anonymity and for the flow of the story, but... and so I come from a very religious family. My parents are very devout Muslims, and I was born here in the UK, but soon after the revolution my parents went back to Iran, so that's where I grew up.
Okay.
In this religious household,
just after the revolution as well, in the early 80s.
It was 81, that exactly in 1981 that they came back, and it's just at the beginning of Iran-Iraq war. So, and my dad used to go to the front line, and we used to sleep under our dining table because a few bombs and company. It was a very interesting time.
So a bit like the contemporary experience, I guess, of being... Well, I know it's kind of stopped now, and the Iran-Iraq war went on for quite a while, didn't it? But the experience of being Iranian, kind of, you're more likely to have experienced war as a civilian, aren't you, I guess?
Yeah. Yes, yeah, we did. That's true. And so, yeah, my childhood was formed by the war, and then teenage years and myself becoming religious and being part of, kind of conforming, being part of that. And then eventually kind of realizing my sexuality, the attraction to men. I mean, I knew that from the very beginning as a child, but that when you're a child, it's all innocent and like, oh, whatever, it's a friend, it's okay. Yeah, yeah. And then you realize actually it's more than friend in your head. So all of those struggles, and my struggle was kind of extra layer of religion and family. And I kind of go through that, and how eventually I kind of accept myself as being gay, and obviously I've never come to out to my family. And the second half of the book is me kind of, how I explain it in the book, going through that back doors of the closet I've always been hiding in, into kind of a Narnia, which is the Tehran gay scene, which is just explaining how that works and how, what was that about. So it kind of, that's this, most of the second half of the book is about Tehran's gay scene.
Were you on Tehran's gay scene then from about like late 90s kind of thing, or a bit later?
Uh, It would have been late night. Well, early 2000s, to be honest. Yeah. I kind of accepted myself at around 22 maybe. I was about 22.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was early 2000s, and I just explored the scene for about like 4 or 5 years before, a little bit more, maybe 5 or 6 years before I came back to London.
The book captures how a bit of an obsession nationally with martyrdom has shaped some boys into soldiers. So was masculinity something you felt at odds with, or was it something you were expected to perform, or was that not a kind of struggle that you felt?
Masculinity is an interesting one, because at the very beginning, at the very beginning of kind of accepting that I'm gay, it was this idea that I have to be masculine. I did have this idea. I did military service, Iranian army as well. That was compulsory. Right. And again, all of this kind of honed this message of being masculine and being, you have to be masculine about everything. But then again, part of Tehran's gay scenes were these characters, which are outrageously camp and flamboyant. And it was just the extreme opposite. And at the time, I felt uncomfortable around them. I said, oh my God, this is too much. I don't want to be seen in the outside.
A lot of young gay men feel that though, don't they? That very sounds very familiar to me at kind of like 18, where you're like, I'm not like that.
Yeah. And then once you get to know them, I actually felt, you start gradually kind of realizing, actually, there's a lot of me is in there. I'm just suppressing it. So it starts with kind of exactly that gradual, but I think there's an extra layer that in Iran, obviously, I worry that if I'm kind of more feminine, I'm going to be called sissy, which I was called in school. I was really worried about all of this kind of name calling. That kind of, am I unintentionally outing myself, especially with this, with exactly a feeling that I'm not yet comfortable with myself.
Yeah.
I haven't accepted myself. I don't want my parents to try and get a whiff of it.
Later in the book, you're working in sexual health in London, advising patients on condoms and STIs. And you write about feeling hypocritical. Why was that?
It was that, well, in Iran, let's say, just it suffices to say, there's no sex education. The parents at all, they don't, I mean, my parents at least definitely did not talk about sex, regardless of my orientation, to anyone. It's a bit kind of don't ask, don't tell sort of a situation. You eventually get married and so on. So the idea of wearing condoms or protecting sex is something that either you just someone, when you meet or date or something, might bring up. Should use a condom sort of a thing or not. The majority of the time they wouldn't. It's just kind of non-existent. So I bring the hypocritical side of things out. It's like, I'm just advising people like, okay, you should wear condoms with this and that and the other, just kind of protect yourself. But I wasn't. The truth is it was just non-existent. There was no culture of like, check yourself every once in a while, have your screening done, and then also use protection.
From being in the Tehran gay scene, there's not that, that doesn't really exist. Yeah, well, yeah, there's no infrastructure for it, I guess, is there?
No, there isn't. I remember how, when I used to go buy condoms, how difficult it was to buy a condom from a pharmacy. It wasn't as difficult in terms of getting, just being shy, did you? So just like, okay, how many rounds should we do? Who's going to go first and who's going to pick it up? And you always get the look, regardless. It's not that the judgment is always there, and just have to kind of suck it up. I say, fine, it doesn't matter. I'm going to buy it anyway.
Your relationship with your mother features quite a bit in the book. Are you out to your mum? Are you out to your parents?
Well, yes and no. I am. The short answer is yes, but that's since just about a year ago, less than a year ago.
Okay.
So I came out eventually at the age of, say, 44, it was at the time, last year, to my parents when they were visiting London. But I didn't come out and say I'm gay, because I just kind of twisted and said, well, I don't live alone anymore and I've got a partner. And when I wanted to say, well, what's he doing? I said, just, he's not home. And was it. That was kind of the pronoun and saying, I don't live at home. That's it. I said, okay, this is me coming out and I'm not going to do any more than that.
Was there a reaction to that, or was it just so kind of like noted?
The thing is, I knew that my parents know. I mean, it's impossible for parents not to know, I think. There have been so many slip-ups in my... I mean, there's still quite a few of them written in the book, which are, some are hilarious, some are just painful. But there are quite a few. So they, I knew they know, but it was this thing that they don't know how to talk about it. I don't know how to bring it up, and they rather not talk about it. And I think that was confirmed as soon as I started the kind of conversation. Mom, Dad, there's something I want to tell you. My mum, which was immediately clicked on and just like, okay, popped in and said, like, whatever is in your private business is your business. I don't need to know.
Right.
And I had to go say, actually, you do. I had to press on, and it was really difficult. I was like, listen, I'm going to have to bring this up, and I'm going to tell you, and you can ask as many questions as you want. You can be involved as much as you want, but I'm not going to pretend that this doesn't exist. So I'm just not going to live that lie, and I'm not going to live a double lie. But if you don't want to be involved, that's your choice. It's not mine. And my mum went on to kind of talk about God and how you can always come back to God, and give a little bit of lecture of that, which I allowed her, but I think she needed it. But she finished with kind of saying, listen, regardless of what you do, no one's gonna love you more than I do. And that was nice. That was enough.
Yeah, that is enough, like, okay. Isn't it? Yeah, that's what you're after, really, isn't it? Yeah. Totally. Yeah. So you left Iran, you built a new life, fascinated by that description of the underground gay scene in Tehran in the early noughties, only on the basis of the fact that I know I was navigating the sort of Manchester, London gay scene in the early noughties, and it was happening all over the world. And there's that show on BBC Three from that very era as well, What It Feels Like for a Girl, which navigates the queer scene in Nottingham. And it's just putting together how that era was for us as queer people all over the world. I think it's fascinating at the moment with everybody kind of looking at that time and thinking they were the good days, certainly in the UK. You left Iran and you built a new life. How did you start the process of reclaiming your story? Do you feel like this book is kind of like closure, that kind of thing?
Well, I hope it does definitely give me a closure. I think it definitely is cathartic writing about it all. It took a while before I started writing about it, and it kind of came in stages because I wasn't sure that. At the beginning, it's all kind of fueled by ignorance. I thought that I didn't think there was anything interesting about my story, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, this is just a story. It's just how I lived it. It was my life. But then I started talking about like little anecdotes of here and there of my encounters of my military service or this and that with my British friends. And they would go, I'm like, this is unbelievable. You should do something with this story. And I was like, should I? Yeah. It just kind of sparked the idea, okay, maybe I should start writing something. And I just gradually, in stages, I started writing. And it felt, I've never felt better. I mean, honestly, I didn't think all of the things that kind of gone through and everything. And I think regardless of how traumatic or non-traumatic or fun that someone's life is, just once you write about it, you feel so much lighter and so much nicer about it all.
I've heard that it's like journaling, isn't it? It's the same principle that once you take a series of things and you put them through that sort of rational bit of your brain that creates a timeline kind of thing of stuff, then you can be more in charge of your own story, can't you? You can put it into context more once you've kind of written it down. I often feel, I hear this especially from queer writers, that they're processing this with you and sharing that with you, and then they gain something from that. And I think it's really interesting. Do you think there's I don't know how you'd feel about this, but you are both queer and you live in exile essentially from the country that you were born in, where you've got a family background, and that does that ever feel a little bit complex, like a kind of invisibility, double invisibility, queer and in exile? And how do you navigate your feelings around that, if you have any?
Well, with Iran, I've got a very kind of a conflicted relationship. I think I always feel about Iran. Obviously, it's a home country. It's where I grew up in. And I've got friends, and I think I mentioned this to someone else earlier, that I never got the same sense of community or kinship with anyone since Tehran's gay scene, which is and it's just that closeness and that kind of relationship is so different and so bigger here in London, and I'm not even into that.
Mm-hmm.
So I do miss that. And but there's so much also to have I've gained by just coming here, the fact that I can write a book, the fact that I can just openly be gay and live with my partner. There's so much more that kind of has been so much more enriching for my life, and I'm so much happier about. So, and then there's obviously the conflict that I suspect I carried with me all my at least younger years. I do kind of a little bit feel like it was because I grew up in Iran. It's because I kind of had this burden of religion at the time with me, and I was so religious about it all. I do feel that kind of sometimes might not ever heal in a way. I just feel like that's just there, and I kind of have to live with it. And I still have got like religious families, and my parents, my brothers are all super religious, and I kind of have to maintain a relationship to a certain extent. It wouldn't be ideal, and I don't think it was ever ideal, and I don't think it will ever be, but I'm content. I think I've kind of gotten where I wanted to.
It's really interesting hearing some of the things you're discussing to do with family in Iran from a conservative religious background, and thinking there's so many of us can relate to a lot of them. For I think the two things that we can all connect on are conservative and religious, and in any context that often leads to difficulties with their queer kids and queer relatives, doesn't it? You know, the conservative and the religious bit. I think it doesn't matter what country you're in. If somebody queer in Iran were to find this book, I presume in secret, what would you want them to know?
To know about the book,
just generally.
I want them to take a bit of hope out of it. I think I don't think my situation is unique, especially not unique to Iranians. I think it can be unique to anyone. Again, as you said, like growing up in a conservative family and a religious family, whatever the religion is. And the same goes with Iran. I think I hope they will see a lot of overlap with the way they are living, and the fact that even at times I felt them, I'm kind of being suffocated, it's quite difficult and so on. There was so much light. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. And that's kind of, I want them to take a little bit of hope out of this, because the bits that I feel really kind of conflicted, I took myself to a psychologist to kind of convert becoming straight. And I did all of those things, but I came out at the end of it, I think, okay, as much as it was all traumatic during the time. And I just, there's this wonderful world of like Iranian queers that they I hope they try to find and kind of connect to, because it's fabulous.
Yeah, it sounds like the perfect kind of community setup, really affirming, I think it is, when you've got a tight community around you, but in such a kind of almost hostile setting around it. But I think that brings some communities, it brings them closer together. There's the pressure on the outside, isn't it, I guess? Majid Parsa, the book is called The Ayatollah's Gaze. It's out now.
Thank you so much.
Stay with me. This is incredibly simple. If you've ever used Grindr, Googled something rather personal, or posted anything political, your data is already being tracked and sold. Think about that. A VPN can make you a lot safer. NordVPN takes about 2 minutes to set up, one click to turn on, and it just runs in the background. There's no effort after that. It's consistently voted number one across a load of metrics for consumers. It's fast, it's secure, and there's no drop-offs. Outcast World listeners can get up to 75% off NordVPN right now, which brings it down to under £3 a month. Go to outcastworld.net, top of the page, tap the link, then you're done. Outcastworld.net for up to 75% off NordVPN.